Hello, this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 48, and today I join John Leisiger here at Sundance in Utah, where we are for the Ancient Philosophy Society. And John was kind enough to comment upon my book, Aristotle, on the Nature of Truth. And as promised from Digital Dialogue, episode 16, where John joined me to talk about his book, Emerson and Self-Culture, a book that I continued to recommend to everyone. He said at that time that he was willing to come on and interview me about my book. So here we are, episode 48. So that's a number of episodes later. But
yeah, unbelievable there. Yeah.
So thanks for doing this, John. It's great to be here in Utah at Sundance. It's a beautiful place. And thanks so much for commenting on the book yesterday. We had a great session, I thought.
Yeah, I did too. And was very happy to do that and to do this. And I'll try not to destroy the show now that you've handed the mic over.
Exactly.
So let me, even though everyone probably knows some of the ins and outs, I'm going to formally introduce you.
Awesome, thanks.
Perhaps in your own words.
Yeah.
So Christopher Long is Associate Dean for Undergraduate Studies in the College of the Liberal Arts and at the Pennsylvania State University.
Indeed.
He's also Associate Professor of Philosophy at the Pennsylvania State University. And he's the author of The Ethics of Ontology, Rethinking an Aristotelian Legacy, 2004. And the book that we're going to be talking about, Aristotle on the Nature of Truth, which came out 2011?
Yeah, technically in November 2010, but okay. I'm not counting.
All right. So technically November 2010 from Cambridge University Press. Right. So once again, another Slack publication
exactly. From
the great Mr. Long.
It's very tough.
And he's also written numerous articles in some really great venues, Review of Metaphysics, Ancient Philosophy, the Southern Journal of Philosophy, Polis, Epoche, Continental Philosophy Review, and Telos.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's get down to it. We'll talk about this book, undoubtedly, Aristotle, and some of the great connections you draw between Aristotle and some American thinkers
right. That
a lot of folk really haven't paid any attention to.
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons why I was really keen on having you come and do the commentary here at the Ancient Philosophy Society, which has a strong contingent of continental philosophers. And one of the things about the book is that it tries to bring Heideggerian phenomenology into dialogue with a certain kind of American pragmatism, particularly Dewey, but then, you know, this American naturalism coming out of Santayana, Woodbridge, and Randall are those figures I focus
on.
So I wanted to have you here as sort of the voice of some of that American side of things, and it's been great to have you here.
So why don't we start with that question about why you decided to include Woodbridge and Randall in particular. What were some of the motivations there? And also, how do you think that enriched your project?
Yeah.
Because I think it did.
No, thanks. Well, I think the you know, I said yesterday that in some ways this book does come out of my move to Penn State and my encounter with Vincent Colapietro and also my encounters with you at SAP and some of those sessions I was at a few years ago where mm-hmm. I think you and I really started talking in a serious way. And what I realized was, you know, it was sort of in some ways coming back to my own tradition, because at the New School I had Dick Bernstein was on my dissertation committee, and I never took a class in pragmatism with him, but I sat in on one that he taught after I was done my coursework, and so I saw the richness of what was offered there, and also recognized, or at least felt like it resonated in so many ways with some of the things I'm interested in Heidegger, you know, on Heideggerian phenomenology, concerned mm-hmm. with this worldliness.
Right.
A concern with a certain kind of embodiment, an unwillingness to posit a subject as separable from the world around us. And so I saw all of these sort of connections, and then having these conversations I was having with you, with Vincent, it made it clear that, you know, sort of read Dewey's experience in nature and saw all these, you know, connections, but also the way in which he himself, Dewey, sort of rips Aristotle apart in ways that I think he probably shouldn't if he were to read a different kind of Aristotle. So I think that's why the American side came into the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I also wanted in some ways to stage a discussion that doesn't happen.
Right.
I mean, I can imagine that Heidegger would have abhorred this, and, you know, probably Dewey too. They probably would have been like, what the heck are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly what one of the things that I'm attracted to in the book is this sense of belonging to this larger conversation that, for reasons of professional habits or what have you, never seems to take place. Let me follow up then with sort of two thoughts. One is, one of the main themes of the book is that Aristotle sort of shows us a way of doing philosophy that you want to continue on with. And you tie it to phenomenology, but then you coin this term legomenology. Maybe you could say a little bit about why you coined the term, what's at stake in the term, what it adds to phenomenology, and then maybe we'll come back around to how that methodological inheritance from Aristotle is maybe one of the reasons methodologically, too, for your inclusion of people like Randall Woodbridge.
No, I think that's exactly right. So one of the things that always struck me about Aristotle is that, you know, he always uses this vocab. He uses legati in the middle voice all the time. And we get that through in translation, you know, things are said of things, you know, things are said in many ways, this famous phrase in Aristotle. But then also, the way in which Aristotle always begins philosophizing by attending to the things said by his predecessors. And then also by the things commonly held, you know, the doxai that are just people think. And, you know, when I first started reading Aristotle, it was sort of like, okay, well, you know, let's get through that, and then let's figure out what he wants to say. And then, and slowly but surely, and, you know, I do think what Heidegger, I guess, I think he says this in the one of the Nietzsche lectures about, you got to begin well with philosophy, you got to do Aristotle for about 10 years. So I figure now I've got my 10, maybe 12 years, and I'm ready,
ready
to start.
You have your launch pad.
And there's a way in which that's true, because, you know, in my first book, I had an Aristotle who was very much at odds with himself in a certain kind of way. And so I know you had been thinking about asking me about the why a second book on Aristotle. One of the reasons is because the book that I wrote, The Ethics of Ontology, has an Aristotle that is sort of in tension with himself. As Frank Gonzalez said in a review he did of it, it's kind of a schizophrenic Aristotle. And I didn't really, and he, Frank really pushed me to think more holistically about Aristotle and what he's doing. So that's, this book is really an attempt to do that in a robust, rigorous way. And so it was the way in which Aristotle attends to the things said as themselves phenomena that lend insight into the nature of things. And so what was powerful for me, and I think something that we in the modern world have a difficult time getting our heads around, certainly since Descartes, and I think one of the things that Heidegger and Dewey saw was that we are always already embedded with the things we encounter, and that includes language. So what I saw, or what I heard, to use the better vocabulary, I think, in Aristotle's approach was, it was attending to the things said, ta legomena, as a way of getting access to the nature of things. Which isn't to say that, you know, language just immediately gives us the nature of things. But there's something discernible in language if we approach it in a certain way that will lend insight into the nature of things. And so that's why I started talking about a legomenology rather than a phenomenology.
Okay. So the sort of logos of what's said in the community as itself a phenomenon is taken to have some indications which will actually further the phenomenological project.
And it has it really is also a way of taking our own situatedness seriously. I mean, in a rigorously philosophical way. We inherit words, we inherit ways of talking about things, and those things that we inherit have to be taken up into ourselves in a critical way, but also recognize that they do resonate in some ways with the truth of things. And I think, you know, Randall's great on that. I mean, Randall really has, you know, he's understood this in a deep way, that, you know, that we are bound up with the history in which we're situated.
Right. So maybe that's something then to turn to you in our earlier discussion in the session you quoted Emerson.
Yeah.
in history and the sense of a kind of...
That was a gesture of kindness.
That was a gesture. I felt the love.
I did. Oh, man. Well, yeah, I will just say, and hold on to that question, because I will say one of the first philosophers that I ever read seriously in undergraduate with Doug Anderson was Emerson. And he had this... He laid out this whole... His theory of the two, you know, the two series of essays, and he laid it out. He read them all during the semester, and then at the end, he put them together in this, like... really interesting way, whether you agree with it or not, it certainly was something that resonated with me, and I've loved Emerson ever since.
We are on the same page in that. So what you had stressed was the notion of a kind of active inheritance of history.
Right.
And there's another line in The American Scholar where he says it's not just creative writing; there's creative reading.
Yeah.
Which plays along with this. So maybe you could say a bit more about this social dimension of the legomenology.
Yeah.
Because there's a way in which, right, one stress could be people have said things and there are resources there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do not presume that all of your predecessors and interlocutors are dimwits.
Right.
There's something to be found there.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts that relation... speaker addressee, that puts the inner subjective relation still oriented primarily towards whatever the subject matter is that we're going to fuss over.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also a sense, it sounds like from Randall, that we can't deny whenever we address phenomena that we are, Emerson language, quoting our predecessors or our peers. So to sort of not engage the other discussants is to sort of just deny really ourselves in a certain way. Again, though, this is still primarily, as we respond to the phenomena, we have to realize that we're repeating things we've received, and we don't want to be ourselves dim-witted because those may mislead us. But also there are things to be gleaned there that could help us. So I'm also interested in thinking about the relation to the discursive community more intersubjectively.
Yeah.
And whether or not, because as we're working our way sort of into the book, we're going to see that its principal concerns are ethical again.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering a sense of what your sense is of, and the legomenology about just your relation socially to peers, to the past, and whether or not the practice of legomenology is political in the sense of negotiating communal disagreements, repeating a certain history, whether or not there's things that are at stake in how we relate to our other discussants.
Right.
That isn't just about whether or not we're going to make progress or make an advance relative to our ability to know things.
Right, right. No, I think that's important. So I think I want to affirm the social dimension of legomenology, both in relation to the past and a particular mode of taking up the past, namely as welcoming it on the one hand, but also as being critical of it. So there's always a matter of contestation, reappropriation, and in being intentional about where we might be saying this is the dimension we want to affirm and this is the dimension that's limited or limiting or something that we want to move beyond. And I think that discussion is something that is can and should be robustly intersubjective in the moment of the now. And in fact, I feel like in some ways we were beginning to perform that in public in the book session because and really prompted by your pushing me on what is the nature of the interlocutor that legomenology engages? And you're asking the same kind of question here. And so I think, when you, John, asked me, as you did yesterday, about the meaning of cooperation in Woodbridge and how I take that up and to what degree do I want to embrace it and what degree do I want to reject it, those are the conversations that establish a community of friendship between us, hopefully with a wider community. And then I think, the thing that you also did so nicely in your commentary, I thought, was press on the idea of the role of the philosopher in terms of saying something about justice, saying something about the relationship between truth and justice, and having think and for how incumbent it is upon us as philosophers simply to not simply it's hard to live by the words we speak and to speak words that nourish relationships and cultivate communities of justice, or at least where justice is a concern. So I want to say, I mean, one of the things that I experience often when I read philosophers with regard to the past is there's such a desire to establish the difference. Like, your thought as different from, as somehow beyond, you know, all of the predecessors. And right. You see that, I think, also in Aristotle, fair enough, too, sometimes.
Sure, in Heidegger, in Derrida, right. Sort of that Bloomian anxiety of influence. Yeah, fully unleashed.
Exactly. And so I wonder if, you know, if we would begin with a kind of presumption of a certain agreement and then say, you know, okay, but then there's all these other issues around the other side that, or around the edges of that word, yeah. Or around the, or what seems to be driving you in that direction to develop it in this way that I want to hold back on.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that, particularly this sense that in the legomenology, that part of what's at stake there, and the question I'm about to ask you is, you know, this book really seems, even though truth is the core of the title, that it's about living justly.
Yeah.
But sort of the transition is that it seems then that legomenology is in attempting to, the general project, the phenomenology and the legomenology, trying to get us to be able to live justly,
right.
That there's this dimension of treating our interlocutors justly,
yeah.
Treating our community justly in how we address them and how we engage them, if we talk about them at all.
Right, you know, right. Who's included, you know, so, excluded.
Yeah, because I think part of the cost of that trying to prove the difference is it becomes an almost de facto subjectivism, as if all of these thoughts came from me. And alongside that de facto subjectivism, which you point out, Randall says, no way, that's not really a credible account. On the other side, though, it is a continual gesture of exile.
Right.
You know, it's completely, it's sort of in a performative way banishing people from the polis as, you know, not really having anything to contribute.
Right.
And maybe not even having, you know, a right to object.
Right.
Because they're just sort of erased.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's true. And I think, you know, this is one of the things that, your book on self-culture actually, I think, does a nice job on trying to get both sides of it. I mean, the need to express yourself as yourself, to find yourself in the engagement with these texts and other things, which could be taken as the sort of positing of oneself over against everything else.
Right.
But then, I mean, you also, and I did only half quote you in the session, so we should get that on tape right here. I didn't emphasize the points that you make about abandonment and the importance of abandonment, as, or at least I read that in a certain way as saying, you know, well, yes, there is a certain way of self-formation, but the self-formation is never consolidates itself in the way that we might think it should.
Yeah, no, exactly. That at one level, building up your own life, once you realize the contours of your own life, is building up the lives of others.
And right, exactly.
There's no choice about, well, I'm no longer going to attend to myself, I'm going to attend to others.
Right.
It's like, well, you can't just do one.
But, and I think we don't do that as philosophers in community. I mean, what we do is we present papers. So usually what we do is we go and we read a lot of stuff alone in our, you know, study. And then we maybe we'll write something up and then we'll submit it, we'll, you know, present it.
Right.
And then, you know, sometimes, and this is one of the things I'm proud of about the Ancient Philosophy Society, is that there's really a community there. You don't have spend the first, you know, three quarters of your paper justifying your existence, you know, only to get to the philosophical points you want to make until the end. Even if there's disagreement, and there is, it's always a kind of community of friendship.
Yeah.
And that's why, and I'm really proud of that, you know, it's something I've intentionally tried with many other great people to cultivate. And that's why it was so special to be there yesterday in front of that group. But the point I want to just return.
Killer
just,
attendance.
It was good. It was good. I liked that. I hope they got pictures. It seemed like they got some good ones. We'll post them on the blog, of course. But that's actually part of the project of this digital dialogue and the kinds of things I'm doing with digital media is to see if I can... I mean, when I started doing this, it was as a result of a faculty fellowship with teaching and learning with technology. And I said, look, here's what I want to do. If you were going to give me a fellowship, it's, you know, just a summer thing. I want to perform philosophical research out loud. I want to do my, I'm writing a book on Socrates and Plato, but I want to just do that out loud.
Yeah.
Because there are going to be some people, a few people who might be interested, and I'm going to have conversations with them, and it's going to enrich the project. And now what I'm seeing is on the other side of this, of this, of the book, Aristotle and the Nature of Truth, it's you know, to have this venue to talk with you about it is really powerful. And I hope that in this I am performing what I try to argue for in the book, which is that the truth is a matter of saying things according to the ways they show themselves, saying
right.
Natural items, natural things, human being, other humans, the things we encounter in its broadest sense,
right.
And responding, learning to respond to them in ways that are concerned for justice.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so that means I've got to be open for when you say, no, that's not what I meant. And I do think, and this goes to a point you were pressing me on, I think, in this session a little bit, about, you know, what kind of response do you get from a rock or from a nun or even from an animal that doesn't have the capacity to say, yo, that's wrong. You know, I don't mean that. So I want to recognize the difference, but I do want to hold on to the idea that, you know, rocks and animals and other, they are saying things to us.
Right.
And we need to attend to those. We need to attend to what they're saying. But it's also challenging in a different way to do that with other human beings. And there's a whole nother level of, you know, sophistication and nuance and complexity.
Yeah, so maybe, I mean, this would be a good time then to move into the kind of core ontological claim of the book. And then we'll come back to some of the issues of the ethics and the justice.
Okay.
And just want to, I mean, I do like the fact that you don't stress it so much in the book, but it does seem as if, you know, friendship is a cardinal virtue of legomenology.
Yeah.
That there's a way in which we could always ask in our attending to the sayings of others about the sayings of things.
Right.
Did we maintain a friendship?
Right.
And could we even, I mean, I'm wondering, I'm just thinking along with you now, like, could you imagine in legomenology there's sort of friendships of pleasure, friendships of use? You know, I don't know what we'd want to say.
Well, I know. I mean, I don't know that I would necessarily want to go as, you know, to just take on board all of, you know, Aristotle's complete understanding of friendship. But what I ended my initial comments yesterday before you, the three, you, Will, and Drew gave your comments. I ended with this quotation from Aristotle about, although our friends are loved, let's sacred to give more honor to the truth.
Right.
And Drew actually had written me back. I said, after I sent that, he said, you know, he's always, you know, not like that formulation, because wouldn't it have been, what if, how different it would have been if Aristotle had said, you know, we're all loyal to the truth, but in the end, friendship, you know, is important. And I wrote back to him and I said, you know, to me, what the first part of the sentence says, you know, both our friends and the truth are loved.
Yeah.
You know, but it's sacred to give more honor to the truth. And so there's a way in which I want to affirm something of that.
Yeah.
But I don't want to, I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which an appeal to the truth, an appeal to, you know, this sort of objective.
Well, but it's as it shows itself.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, this is a.
And so then it's a question of friendship in the truth, in terms of our mutual pursuit of trying to articulate things in accordance to the way they show themselves, in accordance to the way they make sense out of our lives, and they hopefully turn our lives toward the just and the good and the beautiful. So the problem, I mean, well, I don't think it's. I mean, I think Aristotle does perform that probably with Plato. I mean, in a way, and it comes across to us as, you know, man, he's hitting him hard on this whole ideas theory and all of that.
Right.
But, and you know, there's not a whole lot in Aristotle that sort of talks about how great Plato was and how wonderful it was to spend 20 years with this teacher and all of that. But, you know, from my perspective, what he's doing, and I tried to argue this yesterday, is really he's taken a very deep Platonic stance in his way of thinking. And it sort of feels like that's just taken for granted in a certain way, that he,
right.
And that allows him to do this differentiating. But I mean, even the issue in some ways is how do we welcome the disagreement?
Right.
And how do we have a conversation? I feel like if we can start with, okay, here are the places where we have common concerns. Here are the places where our vocabulary resonates. And now you're going to emphasize these dimensions. I would like to emphasize these. Now let's have a conversation.
Right. Yeah.
That's the root of a real philosophical friendship.
Yeah, no, and I like that. And I think that to be able to think ethically about how we even... as scholars, engage one another.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
It's an advance.
This is a turning of the tables a little bit. But one of the things that I really enjoyed about the Emerson book is the notion of the eloquent life.
Right.
And so I feel like I'm trying, in some ways, when I talk about legomenology, there is a sense of what I think you're getting at with the notion of the eloquent life, although maybe you could say a word or two about that. I just put you totally on the spot.
That's fine. No, I mean, the idea of the eloquent life is that my conduct speaks in the way in which you talk about
right,
everything having a kind of logos to
right.
it, a characteristic way of presencing. That's
right.
the way I sort of put in my first project.
Right.
That's articulate to those who can... Right,
attend, hear it, can hear
yeah,
it, right.
see it,
right.
you know, read it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want in our conduct is that it eloquently testifies
right.
to those things we are most committed to,
right.
such that our ethos
mm-hmm.
is luminously present or right articulate
right.
in our very actions,
right.
And that would include how we address and engage one another,
right.
And I sort of suggested this a little yesterday, and I said, you know, partly all thinkers say lots of things,
right.
but then let's see what they do
right.
rhetorically.
Right.
And that in that practice, you see some of their commitments.
Right. Right.
Now, they may not have right signed up for those commitments
right.
propositionally,
yeah.
but you see that they're committed to them because of the way in which it organizes
yeah.
their being at work.
Well, what's interesting about that whole commentary that you made, I mean, you showed me something about myself that you're exactly right, that I didn't really thematize in the book. And it is a kind of rhetoric of welcoming, a rhetoric of, you know, finding the places of commonality, even between Heidegger and Dewey, for example,
sure.
or between, you know... Randall, I you know pointed to those passages where he talks
yeah,
about
the hermeneutic he has.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I mean, there and so, but I just think that you know, let's disagree, fine, and let's have it out. I mean, let's really have disagreements about real things and have it out. But let's if we can start on at a level of okay, this is why you develop that set of ideas, that vocabulary. And I see that. I actually would put it maybe a little bit differently. I think we're going to have a lot more productive kinds of conversations. Now, there is something productive about the agon, yeah, you know.
Right.
But I just find it's more, it leads to ill will, it leads to, you know, feelings of, it's... I don't really. Well, I was going to say, and well, now I'm saying it. It's
gonna.
A kind of a masculine thing in a bad masculine way.
Yeah, no,
you know,
sure.
It's just like, you know, you're showing your feathers. You're doing all this. You know, you're up there, and you're like, you got to prove your chops and all this. And it just doesn't. It's not conducive to real philosophical. I don't want to say progress, but movement toward. Anything that's
yeah.
just or good or beautiful.
Yeah, it's not generative.
Right, exactly.
Well, I take that back.
It
is in
be.
A certain way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but
right.
maybe not in ways that we want to sign on for. So let's then talk some... Well, since we've moved back to ethics,
yeah.
then we'll come
yeah.
back to cooperation. So,
yeah.
You know, so the title, Aristotle on the Nature of Truth, you get a little bit into it, and it's clear that... the book's really about living justly.
Yeah.
Right? That's
right.
the principal theme. I mean,
yeah.
can you say a little bit about sort of the conception? Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm glad that I was given it, you know, because otherwise I would have had to save the receipt.
Right.
Two parts, right?
Yeah.
The first part is say a little bit more, and we've moved around this some,
yeah.
the sort of conception of living justly
mm-hmm.
that's at the heart of the book. And why it's not a bait and switch is because living justly requires us to, in a sense, be responsive and to cultivate the responsibility to be responsive to the truth.
Right, right.
So, I mean, I think it's a real powerful position that you develop. Yeah. So maybe share that
so
with us.
I mean, what ended up happening is, you know, this whole approach to one's predecessors, and then, of course, trying to take this legomenological approach into the text itself and think about how I can respond to Aristotle's text in a way that's responsible and that really is attentive to what he's saying there, led me into the notion that, yeah, what truth here for Aristotle is not just correspondence of ideas to things but or objects, but is the ability to respond together with things. And then, it made it clear, well, to me, when I sort of made that shift, well, what is it that's actually holding me accountable in what I say? I mean, right. one could, predicate anything of anything, and yet we can't, because there's a claim to truth, namely, things don't show themselves in a certain way, and they hold us accountable in some way. So then as I developed that idea, it really became clear to me, okay, what I'm interested in is, and I use the formulation a lot in the book, is doing justice to things,
right.
Which is basically the idea that you in attempting to articulate what they are and where we are with them,
sure,
we have to attend to what they're saying, but we also have to recognize that we're also involved in the process. So that's why the emphasis on the middle voice was so important.
Just in case someone listening doesn't know what's at stake in the middle voice,
yeah.
Why don't you just say
so? What's interesting about the Greek language is that they have an active voice, I ran, and then they have a passive voice, I was beaten up, to use the fist fight in that example you did yesterday, which was funny. And but then there's this kind of untranslatable middle voice that is neither active nor passive in Greek, and so it can sometimes. Words can take on different meanings when they're in the middle voice. So something that means free in Greek, if you put it in the middle voice, it actually means ransom yourself. So you're freeing yourself for your own benefit. There's a kind of reflexivity that comes back on you with it. So, but what's powerful philosophically about the middle voice is that it really problematizes our modern attempts to, or tendencies to parse everything into passive, active, subjective, objective. And so what we realize is that when we think and we attend to the middle voice in Aristotle when he talks about perceiving, it's not just that I am imposing things on things as they give themselves to me, but we're engaged in an activity where we're both active and we're both passive. We're both the thing I'm perceiving is being perceived and also also doing something in the process.
Right.
And as I'm perceiving. So I wanted to really highlight that. And then that's probably going to get us to the cooperation concept in a minute. But what I want to get to this idea of justice, because what ended up happening in the end of the book was, okay, well, what is it about logos that humans have that might be different than, the rest of nature? And Aristotle does make a point about justice being basically a human concern. And he also talks about justice, in different ways. But when he talks about justice as the whole of virtue, I wanted to emphasize that. And part of what he suggests there, and I admittedly am taking this and making a lot out of it, and I'm moving beyond him in this, but is to say there's something about our ability to contextualize our relationships with things we encounter in the context of a larger whole. Not that we have full access and grasp of the larger whole, but at least that it is available to us to be concerned about.
Right.
And that's really the concern for justice, the concern for, as we were talking about, the beautiful and the good. That ability to allow the things we say to be animated by those concerns. What is just? Is this just?
Right.
That really is a key component to what we are doing as human beings.
Right. So in a way, then, I mean, the the book gives us a kind of portrait of human being in the world.
Yeah.
And there's a way in which human being in the world, as you present it, sort of lives under a kind of call to justice.
Yeah.
In our everyday engagements with things.
Right.
You know, there's a good English phrase, you know, American English, he did right by me.
Right.
You know, so we do, I mean, we have this thought is sort of deposited at various points in our language of having appropriately, you know, addressed, engaged someone in that particular situation. I mean, when people say he did right by me, they usually don't mean, you know, as, you know, an immortal soul, you know, created in all equality. It's saying, you know, it suggests that in this particular situation, that was,
you know, the
right
formulation
response.
Itself, and this would be a good example of the Gomenology at work, and that formulation, he did right by me, I mean, that may be a really good illustration of a kind of middle voice way of speaking. Because what are you, when you say that, he did right by me, she did right by me, you are talking about yourself as an object, but you're also affirming a certain kind of activity that was done. And so you're affirming yourself as both active and passive in this locution.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no, sure.
And I think, and that's why probably, I mean, it just came, I mean, I talk a lot about, you know, doing justice in this.
Right.
And doing justice to things. And at some points I did worry about, okay, am I using that term? Is it too, that phrase, is it too, is there just too much packed into it that I'm relying on it too much? I decided to leave it as it is because I do think it's a very rich way of formulating things.
So let's, continuing a little bit more on this ethical line of thought.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned to you, you know, it's a little startling that eudaimonia, flourishing happiness, doesn't make many appearances. I can't actually remember it making an appearance, but I didn't word search it or go back.
And, right, we'll have to get the PDF.
Well,
the index doesn't have it.
Okay, the index does not have it.
So
that's, I think, sufficient to indicate that it's not playing a significant role for you.
You better check to see it. I'll be embarrassed when it does happen.
Yeah.
But I don't think it does. I mean, and, you know, you're... It doesn't have eudaimonia. Does it have happiness? No, probably not. But, you know...
So I'm just curious about
that. It's an important idea. It's not... You're exactly right. It's not because the idea is not in there. You know, there's been so much written on eudaimonia in Aristotle, and there's so much important thing. There's so many important things to say about it as an activity, as a way of thinking about living. I mean, it really means to live well, right? So it's not obviously this sort of happiness in the sense of a subjective.
Woo-hoo!
Exactly. I do that with my students all the time. So, but yeah, I mean, in one way, it's not spoken in the book, but that's what the book is about. I mean, it's about living well. It's about how do we allow the question of a good life, the question of a just life, the question of a beautiful life to inform the ways we respond to one another, the things we say, and in saying also do, the things we do with one another and with the world. And to become, to allow all of our ways of saying and ways of being in the world to be informed by a concern for the good and the just.
Right.
The
Because I do think, I think that there's a disjunct in the modern moral imagination between flourishing and justice.
Yeah.
And we tend, for some of the reasons we talked a little bit earlier about self-culture, we tend to think flourishing's, it's about me, baby.
Right.
And every once in a while, I got to make sure I worry about others.
Yeah.
And that even is part of the struggle in the Nicomachean Ethics, where it's only in the justice chapters. It's like, oh, yeah, other people. That said, though, and I'm just sort of, I'm now going to rephrase what I heard you say and see what you think. You know, I mean, what I got out of the book with regard to eudaimonia is that, as you said, eudaimonia is living well. It's flourishing. It's sort of virtuoso living.
Right.
It's all of the principal human capacities to the degree possible are being performed at this virtuoso level. And because we're human and we have nous and we have the logos, we couldn't ever claim to be living in a virtuoso manner if we were not, right, right. doing justice.
Right.
So there's a way in which, as I read the book, mm-hmm. Living justly, doing justice to things, mm-hmm. doing justice to those who also say things in an effort to do justice
right.
to things.
Right.
That sense of doing justice is, in a sense, a kind of essential, necessary condition for any human being right. being able to claim that flourishing.
Right.
Now, not a 2-year-old.
No.
Because they're not capable of the right. saying. And,
right.
And,
right.
And you right. know, the skull's just closed. And so, noose is
still
only just stopped, you know,
right.
seeping out.
Right.
But what do you think about that?
That's exactly right. And what I think, and just to stick with the 2-year-old in a way, I mean, there's a way, I mean, what you emphasized about the performative side of what I was doing was really appreciative. I appreciated it because when we start thinking about performance and performing a virtuoso life, we also have to think about the habits we cultivate in one another, in our children, in the people we encounter, our students.
Yeah.
And so what I want to emphasize also is, yeah, it's all well and good to talk about doing justice to things and, you know, responding with a concern for, you know, the way the other shows themselves and all that, but it's hard. I mean, it is hard to do it, really to do it, not just like, you know, when you're writing a book about it, but to do it in your family life, in your teaching life, and, you know, more and more in my life, in my administrative life. I mean,
sure.
There are ways to do it within the context. It has to be done differently. But, you know, for me, it's a matter of trying to figure out where that integrity of doing justice to the concerns, these concerns, I mean, you know, about what it is to be educated, for example, when we're in our academic institutions and things. What are we doing with education? What, you know, why are we concerned about this, and this? And, you know, we get so caught up often administratively in, you know, these things that are just tangential to the educational mission of these
sure.
institutions we're dealing with.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it's, but it does involve cultivating habits, and you need to practice it. You know, you
right.
need to practice it. You need to be, you know, you need to be disagreed with, and you need to sort of move through that disagreement into
yeah.
another place and figuring out, you know, how to, again, try to articulate things in ways that are conducive to flourishing in the rich sense that you mean it, namely as flourishing together. It's a conjoint activity in the Deweyan sense, I think.
Yeah, no, that's right, because it's not, you know, it's just I can't.
Right.
I'm reproducing the lives of those around me.
Right.
Just in virtue of reproducing my own.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So how about then? Let's talk some about the ontological core.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of the discussion, and that is that. So I've written this out to try to say
okay.
it in a clear way.
Do justice to the.
Well, yeah, exactly. So we could say that the core ontological claim of the book is that human beings at the level of perception, mm-hmm. thought, and articulation exist in a cooperative dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of in a doing way call it a transactional communication.
Right. Right.
But a cooperative dialogue with things
mm-hmm.
In their singularity.
Right.
You describe that as their unicity.
Right.
But not just in their singularity. Also their systematic interrelation.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll be careful about systematic, but yeah, I mean, okay.
Okay, yeah, we can
yeah.
can fuss over that. And the and so then just to repeat, right, the core claim is that human beings at the level of perception, thought, and articulation exist in a cooperative dialogue with things in their singularity and their thoroughgoing interrelation.
All right, look at that.
Right. And so
yeah.
What at base do you think sort of justifies this claim?
Yeah.
I mean, if you could give us the mini version, and I don't mean textually in terms of Aristotle, because just
right.
more in sense of you're
yeah.
using Aristotle, but you're throwing this down into the sensus communis
yeah.
and saying, great line, the translation of Tattvama si in the Upanishads, that thou art.
Right.
Right, after all these descriptions, and then it just says, that thou art.
Right.
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 So,
right.
In a way, that's sort of, I think,
yeah.
the part of the address of the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what I go back to, in some ways perceiving in Aristotle, but just the very rudimentary level of how we encounter anything.
Right.
We have to have access. If I had no access visually, auditorily, tactily to the world, that we wouldn't be having a discussion. Would be possible. So, and in really, that's the level at which there has to be an essential cooperation, namely a working together of, as Woodbridge nicely puts it, of the capacities of the soul with the things that it is capable of encountering.
Right.
So I want to emphasize that dimension of cooperation, and perhaps something that I probably could have done more carefully in the book, distinguish it from the way in which you and I in interacting may cooperate or not.
Right.
There has to be some general sense of cooperation for us to understand each other's language, for us to be able to see one another and to, you know, read gestures and other things. But that's just the baseline. I mean, that's the basis on which all kinds of possibilities open
right.
up.
Sure.
And so the working together is simply that we can encounter each other.
Right.
And in really, just because I know you were going to, there's something that came up in the session at the end, and I didn't have a chance to really flesh it out, but it's this formula. The hardest sentence I wrote in the book, as I said, is God is relationality. And Drew, in his commentary, sort of quickly moved into you used to take God as relational.
Right.
And
God doesn't relate
right.
to
and
other
that,
beings.
Right. And I wanted to push back. Exactly. And I wanted to push back. And say, right, but I said God is relationality. It's not that we have a relationship to something called God. It is that relationality is possible. Right. That's really what I want to say. And name that God. Let's call that divine. That relationality, that we can relate to things.
Right.
That is
gotcha.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
And I think, and I'm really, if I'm willing to call anything divine, that's divine.
Okay.
To say God is relationality is to say, you know, so many things are fraught in there. Just saying God is already fraught. But I don't want it, I don't want it to be read in this sense of, you know, your personal relationship with God. It is that, the capacity to relate is divine.
Right.
It is a remarkable thing that is just a condition of our world and our universe. And that it should be and not otherwise is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. So then let me throw something back and
okay.
see.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, so it strikes me that your access or your ultimate defense of the claim that we exist in this cooperative dialogue,
yeah.
It sort of follows this nice phenomenological path in a way of sort of repeating Kant, who asks about the conditions for the possibility
right.
of experience.
Right.
And in a way, you're saying, you know, the conditions for the possibility of experience are, right, these ontological cooperations.
Yeah.
And if we're good enough at doing the kind of phenomenology that we need to do, rather than just importing our presumptions
right.
in the sort of first critique way,
right.
what we're going to find is that we are in this ongoing
right.
Cooperative dialogue.
Yeah.
And I mean, I appreciate the language of cooperation in the sense that we couldn't do what we do when we see and we hear and we smell,
right.
when we speak to one another, if my word is enable.
Mm-hmm.
So I talk about
sure.
enabling conditions.
Yeah.
That's sort of my Kantian
mm-hmm.
revision.
Right.
Right. If the world didn't enable that. Just like we
yeah.
couldn't breathe,
right? If we couldn't deal with if our lungs couldn't deal with oxygen,
yeah,
you know, and the same. I mean, that was the point about the digestion that you pressed me on, Woodbridge emphasizes digestion has this dimension of cooperation, and what in part he means, I think, is that food gives itself to us in the sense of allowing digestion takes out what we can use. And of course, what I find remarkable too about it is that though it produces waste, There's stuff it can't use. So there's a way in which I want to leverage that very idea to say, look, this is part of what I mean about the remainder. It's not the analogy is not quite right because it's not like we process everything and then we have this remainder out there that's just
no,
like,
I got you.
Crap. But
so it's not full mutual presence.
Right, exactly. I would delineate. I mean, Woodbridge has a whole discussion of different realms of being.
Yeah.
And that, we have to treat that very carefully because his realms of being are not real realms in the sense of divorced from each other. They need to be understood.
Analytically distinct.
Exactly.
Right.
There you go.
But don't get greedy.
Don't get greedy. Okay, good. Don't reify that. So, I don't know that I'm going to take on, I have an allergy to the realms of being talk.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, yeah.
Unless you can be king and all of that. Right.
Right. But, you know, what digestion is to the realm of the physical corporeal world, maybe articulation is to the conceptual world, the realm for Woodbridge. So I want to take that on board in some ways, but really the insight from Woodbridge is in his book on Aristotle's vision of nature, which you know, really takes as its centerpiece the idea, the remarkable recognition that Aristotle made central to the De Anima, that the capacities of our soul operate together with the way things present themselves.
Right.
To some degree. Then yeah. Things don't present themselves completely, but we can perceive.
Right. Right? So there is some cooperation there. There's what's codependent origination, right. That kind of Buddhist phrase.
But I like your enabling possibilities.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, I mean, because I can easily fall into conditions for the possibility in this Kantian sense. Now, when I say that, I've somehow convinced myself that I don't have to take on board the entire, you know, transcendental, you know,
all
that.
I don't think you did.
Right. Yeah, I hope not. But, you know, it can sometimes seem that way.
Right.
Know?
Well, that gets back to the other issue of having to then explicitly say what you're not taking
right,
on board
exactly,
and why.
Exactly. Right.
So that's part
and
of
I
your digestion, right?
Right. Exactly.
You're digesting that word,
and we got a little.
And some of the things are coming out the other end.
Exactly. Exactly.
I suggested, because of time, I felt like I had to rush through certain things. So I didn't get yesterday to say, but I think a point which speaks very much in your favor about our ability to be beings that perceive,
mm-hmm.
that think,
mm-hmm.
and that make declarative statements,
right.
that define, that ask questions. So whatever we think the various modes of articulation are,
right.
To be a being that has logos in that sense,
right.
that... our very ability to do that is precisely a kind of "quote unquote" cooperative relation,
right.
With the things of the world,
yeah,
and probably more than just the things—the atmosphere,
yeah,
nature,
well, and again,
the elemental
things. I do want to put in the broader. I mean, it can be, and you press me a little bit on this. It can be other humans,
yeah.
It can be situations. It can be. I mean, pragma in Greek can do all this, and it does. I mean, and so I was very allergic to the vocabulary of things in my first book. I had this whole thing about things and the ontology of things, which I was, because for me in that first book, things were, you know, reified. They were objectified in a way that but if you really open up the possibility of what things can do for you, you know, it can be anything that shows itself in a determinate way.
Right.
You know, so, and I do want to expand it to atmospheres and allow it to call into question our relationship with the globe and with the cosmos, as well as our relationships with one another.
So if that ongoing cooperation with those various levels of the things of nature.
Right. Well, can I just pause, because I want you to ask a question, but I want to... Because now I'm worried about this cooperation in the sense in which you just used it, because... We cooperate with those things just insofar as we can encounter them.
Exactly.
Right?
No, it's not a willful...
Right. It's not like I agree with them.
Today I'm going along with gravity.
Right.
Tomorrow I'm not sure.
Exactly.
No, exactly.
Right.
So this is... I mean, I'm glad you bring that up, because this is There are no, on my view, there are no magic phenomenological words.
Right.
The goal of phenomenology is to have come upon the proper name of all of the Zaka,
right,
in that sense of thing, right?
Yeah.
All of the phenomena.
Right.
So instead, what we're dealing with is we're generating this language and sharing it with each other in this in this community of interlocution, and then we see how far it gets us, and we fuss with where it interrupts us. And so,
but the fussing, and you keep talking about the fussing. I mean, the fussing is that's
the word.
That's it. That's the word.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. So it's not just mere fussing. It's the fussing is about getting it right.
Yeah.
Saying it well.
Right. And for me, I mean, fussing is a little detail thing. Yeah. Like, you start fussing because it's just not quite right.
Right. Well, you're concerned about getting it right, but you're concerned about doing justice.
Yeah,
And I think when we fuss, that's what we're doing. And those are the, and when we do that, and, you know, that's been the great thing about conversations you and I have had, too, is that, you know, the fussing can be playful. There's contestation, but there's, you know, I think this is another kind of critique of a professional philosophical world where everything is serious. And right, exactly. He's looking very serious on tape there. But you can't see that.
I was filling my ribcage over there.
Exactly.
Expanding.
You know, we don't play enough, and there's something really fun about saying, okay, what is this thing with cooperation? Now, what's good about it? What's bad about it?
Yeah.
You know, what's appealing about the comparison to digestion? What doesn't quite work?
Yeah.
But that's where that's where the fun is. But I also think that's where it's also utterly serious in terms of doing justice to what we're trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a way in which to push the digestion thing further. That is a way of digesting that linguistic inheritance that Randall talks about in the very practice of the legomenology.
Yeah. And I mean, I wonder what you would say, because, I mean, I don't know if we can push it too far, because on the one hand, you know, there's nourishing dimensions of that digestion, right?
Sure.
You get nourished, but you can also get sick, right?
No, that's right.
It can make you sick. And so there's a way in which so there's that. But then the other side of it is, let's not forget we're appropriating. You know, my reading of Aristotle is still an appropriation. I mean, I'm not going get back to what he probably didn't even have the objective reality of what he was, you know, completely accessible to himself, you know.
Because it was never finished and present to his mind.
Right. But why do we import this idea of the genius back into philosophers as if it was like they're unfolding the system in this way? I mean, Aristotle gets it a lot. I mean, if you really read those texts, it's like, you know, it's taken me a long time to wean myself from that vision of Aristotle as systematic, and because he does have a vision of the whole.
Right.
And it's powerful. But what he shows you is a thinking on the way.
Right.
And that never allows itself to close.
That's right.
You know.
You know, and I think you're right. I mean, not believing that, I mean, how part of this is how we relate to our sayings of things.
Right.
With what mood and temperament, seriousness, playfulness, with what precision, not pretending that we have more precision than we actually have. And, you know, that ongoing, and that does bring us kind of back to this sort of inner subjective contestation.
Yeah. Well, and it also brings us to some of the things that Drew was pushing me on about finitude, and I was trying to push back with him a little bit, saying, look, he is someone who's emphasized the importance of the central role of finitude in Plato, and yet he denies it of Aristotle for, I think, some reasons that I can sympathize with in some level, but I think... you know, the sensitivity to finitude is always operating in Aristotle, I think.
Yeah, if finitude means, encounters with our own limits.
Right.
Yeah.
And
which we have transgressed poorly.
But an unwillingness to fall into the delusion of, divinity, and namely that we are somehow divine and have access, full access to the whole of things.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's the important point about our relationship to our own finitude is, you know, how do you respond? Do you want to cover that over pretend it doesn't exist and presume that you have access to things that you
right.
And then just simply hold on for dear life to that because that's what's making sense of your world. Or do you want to recognize that but not give up on the desire to understand more fully, to do justice, to live with a concern for the beautiful and the just.
Yeah, let me. I'm going to shift a little here because of what you just said, which is interesting. It recalls to me, like almost everything recalls to me, a line in Emerson, In Circles.
Yeah.
And he says the following thing. I'm just paraphrasing. That, you know, every thought sort of rises up like a wave.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of creates a circle around us, and that enables us to make our way through the world.
Right.
But at its crest, it freezes and hems us in.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a strong soul to propel itself past it, re-enter the water, and then have the new thought emerge.
Right.
What's interesting in Emerson there is that he actually attributes that kind of what Nietzsche would call will to self-preservation as also part of the life of thought.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't say only jerks do this.
Right.
He doesn't say that this is some epistemic mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And if only. Mm-hmm. He just says every thought.
Yeah, every thought.
And this is why he'll say in The Poet that, you know, every thought is itself in a way a kind of prison.
Right.
But he thinks about it in this temporal way. So given the sort of naturalist picture that you've given us, conception you've given us of how we belong to the world, where do some of those more pig-headed, self-preservation, actively reifying tendencies emerge? And do you agree with Emerson that they're not just sort of like epistemic mistakes or things that only certain jerks have?
No.
But that this is part of also the life that you so, I think, ably articulate.
Yeah, I think there's a way in which being a kind of being that is aware of one's own limits is traumatic. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, we are dealing with the fact that we know that we're not here forever. We know that down somewhere there's going to be an end to this, this determinate existence.
Yeah.
And can we cultivate in ourselves ways of relating to that end, to our own end, that are not destructive and that are not delusional?
Right.
The tendency to say, well, you know, there's this other life after that. There's going to be all hunky-dory. It's going to be sweet. You know, just live well here and it'll be great there. To me, that's just delusion.
I call that the fundamentalist buyout.
Right,
they object to the federal buyout, but they're happy to have the buyout, from the big White House in the sky.
Exactly. So, and I think, you know, so even though there's a caricature in that, it's a human tendency. I mean, Dick Bernstein calls it the Cartesian anxiety, where he says, you know, a firm foundational principle that we could just hang our hat on, and then we would be okay. We know things would be, you know, we need a certain kind of security, and I want to say we want it. We want that security in a certain way. There's a core part of us human beings who want it, but we can't have it. Okay, and the sooner we get our minds around that, we can't have what we most want in a certain way, then we can go about the harder task of living together in the light of that.
Right.
And I think about that with, you know, my daughters, with how we talk about death, and they have a remarkable way of just responding now as matter-of-fact things. There's a sadness, there's a worry about it, but it's sort of like, well, do you wonder what would happen? I don't know, and... You know, we have to cherish our time together,
right?
You know, and do the best we can with one another to live eloquently, live in a virtuoso way.
Right. So, in a way, it's a sort of fundamental insecurity of the human condition that leads each thought to say, "This is good enough. I don't want to go over that rim again and start over and generate all
but
over
I think
again."
What your quote from Emerson is also getting at something, you know. Else about it, which is that there's an inertia about the ideas.
The very generation of our logos has a kind of life expectancy, and it doesn't die gracefully. And
right.
It's a sort of,
it resists.
It isn't
its own
a
death.
Philosophical thing. It's not like, and it's supplemented with a Cartesian anxiety. So if we weren't Cartesians, it means even pragmatic reckoners get stuck in the ruts.
Right,
and that's
just
an interesting, like, what, you know, some sense of the human animal.
Yeah.
Drifting.
Right.
I mean, this is a way of getting finitude in a different sense.
But I think also, I mean, there's a way in which everything resists. I mean, you know, all natural beings resist. They want to hold themselves in existence. I mean, Spinoza's good on this.
Yeah, it sounded like,
And so I think there's, you know, and I think ideas probably operate in a similar way in some ways, you know. And they do imprison us in ways, but they also, you know, they can empower us to think, you know, other thoughts that are, you know, even more perhaps nourishing, hopefully. I mean, if we're trying to think with an eye toward what allows for flourishing.
So let me maybe one more?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay. I'm going to cheat and do two, but one's quick, because you already talked a little bit about the divinity. And I wanted to ask you whether or not any thoroughgoing account of this fundamental cosmic cooperation which enables each being to be the kind of being it is.
Because
it's also true of, you know, if we had a different gravitational system, none of the world we have would exist.
Right.
So,
a little closer, a little further from the sun, we would be completely different.
There's a, you know, each being, even in its singularity, exists in this oikos of cooperation.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's very powerful in the way you present it. And one question is whether or not every ecology, even then thinking about the cosmos itself as a kind of ecology with little microecologies instead of realms of being, that whether or not any good account of those ecologies requires some notion of the divine. Because it does in Aristotle to get the motions going. But you said something sort of interesting. I mean, you said that relationality is divine. Our capacity to relate is divine. So how much of this is for you an explanatory point in an ontological sense to understand the conditions for the possibility of relationality, and how much of it is a term of praise and veneration, of honoring relationality, such that you'd want to talk about it's sacred. But whether or not we talk about divinity, the divine, God, I'm wondering, do you see there's a sort of ontological versus a kind of, you know, more or less ethical discourse, but not in terms of right and wrong, in terms of our sense of its relative importance in the order of values.
So I do want to resist the you know, once again positing the divine as a causal explanation of things. So that's not what I mean. But I do want to say that thinking about the divine as relationality, as the very capacity to relate, for things to relate, has an has explanatory value. I mean, in the sense that that we can think about the nature of what is in terms of relationality. Now, I mean, it's very interesting that the scientifically, every, you know, we can look way back in time to the, you know, to the moment of singularity, but you can't see that, you can't experience that. You can only experience once differentiation has occurred or whatever, where relational, where things are able to be in relation to one another. So I think there is, I mean, even in a deep scientific level, we might pursue that question of relationality. But then on the other side, the affirming of and the sacredness of relationality, of our relations with things, is, I think, critical. And if it is heard in this book, then I feel like the book is successful because, you know, we live in relations with everything. And if we don't tend to that, to those relationships, and think about how we're responding to one another and to the things we encounter, then there is no hope of living a just life or a flourishing life for anybody, for any of us, for the things of nature, for human beings. And so, you know, attending to that is critical.
Yeah. Well, maybe that is a good place to end, yeah. I think.
Thank you, John.
So, yeah, great conversation. Yeah. Thanks for giving me the helm for this conversation.
And I really appreciate being asked questions and having to respond. And this has been great. Thanks.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.